Accession number 30,001, Mr. Peter Est, Rib 6. Now, what about the declaration of war then? That was just before you went back to 46 Squadron, from the looks of what it was, on the 3rd of September anyway. What do you remember?
I was in 73 Squadron. I'd gone back to... I'd been in 73 Squadron about a week or two when war was declared. We were at RAF Digby, and we were in the mess. It was a Sunday, September the 3rd, 1939. And we knew that the Prime Minister was going to speak at 11 o'clock that morning. And we were pretty certain what he was going to be saying. So all the officers were in the mess, listening to the Prime Minister on the radio. And that was Chamberlain, of course. His words vaguely or roughly were that he'd been out to Germany and met Hitler about a year before and had come back thinking that we would not be having war with Germany anymore and that everything was under good control. Instead of which, Hitler decided to continue with his offensive attitudes and operations, and he went into Poland, and it was that really forced our Prime Minister get a message across to Germany saying that if they didn't pull out from Poland within a certain period of time, then we would declare war on them. Well, they didn't pull out. And this is when Chamberlain was talking on the radio. He said that he tried his best to avoid war, but Hitler was not in any way going to cooperate. And therefore, as from now, we are at war with Germany.
Now, how did you and the rest of the pilots react?
Well, we wondered what the devil was going to happen. We didn't know. Had no idea.
Were you pleased at all, or excited, or what?
No, I don't think we were very pleased, but I think everyone was wondering what the hell was going to happen to us. Well, we knew that our squadron had been destined to go to France if war was declared, along with three other Hurricane squadrons. So there were four Hurricane squadrons who went to France right from the beginning. There was number one squadron, who'd been based at Tangmere. Number 73 squadron, that was us, we were based at Digby. And then the other two squadrons, number 85 and 87, were based at RAF Debden in Essex. And when we went to France, 73 squadron and one squadron went to Le Havre. And we were there for 2 or 3 weeks.
Now, tell us about the trip out. I mean, did you fly out or?
No, I went by boat.
Now, why was that?
Because I was really too inexperienced to join the flight out there. And we took about 15 aircraft, if I remember rightly. We had about 18 or 19 pilots. So, couldn't all fly. And I was the most junior at the time, I was one of the ones selected to go by boat, and went with our medical officer, our doctor.
And do you know what day you went? What the date was? It was pretty quickly, wasn't it?
Oh yes, I can't remember exactly. It was about a week after war was declared.
And what was the journey like? You know, the voyage like.
Oh, it was okay. We went by train to Southampton, and there we boarded a troop ship, and we went across the Channel to Le Havre. I can't remember the name of the ship.
What happened when you got to France? What was your first impression of what that?
and of course, on board the ship, we had a lot of vehicles as well. And then we had more vehicles taken in other ships. But so we had to get in these vehicles and make our way to this convent just outside Le Havre, which we'd been allocated to us by the French as a, and it was our officer's mess.
I presume it was empty then?
Yes, they'd taken all the ladies out.
What was it like as a billet, the convent?
Well, we had one big room where all the pilots were on camp beds. There were about 15 or 16 of us in the room. The CO and the two flight commanders had their own rooms, small rooms in the building. But nearly all the pilots were in one large room on camp beds.
Was the airfield Octeville that you were?
Yes.
Was that nearby?
Yeah, right, very close by. And I think that was why the French had allocated this convent to us, because it was so close to the airfield.
Now, can you describe the airfield? I presume it was a grass one.
Oh, yes, yes. It was just a plain grass field, and whether it had been used, I think it must have been used as an airfield prior to us going there, but otherwise it wouldn't have been in a fit state to use. But I don't know who used it, whether it was a private or whether the French Air Force used it now and again, I have no idea.
Now, so you were in these billets next to Octaville Airfield. Now, when did you make the first flight? Is that this one on the 18th of September?
I would think that's about the date that I first flew there. Is that what it says in the book?
It says it's your first taste of operational flights. What was happening in the air? What was the air situation, if you see what I mean?
Were you
in touch with the enemy?
No way. And we used it for practice flying.
But give us an idea of what these practice flights were like. One thing that I noticed we missed out was formation flying. Now,
yes.
In your training. Now, had you done much in training?
Oh, yes, I've done quite a lot.
Can we sort of look at these practice flights and concentrate a bit on formation flying, which I admitted?
Yes, and then we used to practice attacks, air attacks.
Well, those two things are probably the key things. So formation flying first. What was it like flying into hurricanes in formation?
Oh, they were very good. Yeah.
So what formation were you adopting?
Oh, we always used to fly in fixes of three. Leader, number two this side, number three on the port side.
And level, those two level. The other one.
Yeah. And then as you turn, of course, you all turn together.
And how close?
Oh.
Roughly.
Half a wingspan.
So to a civilian would be very close.
Yes.
Now, was it easy to fly in formation like that? I mean, what was the knack of it?
You got used to it. Because, you see, in my case, I'd done quite a lot of formation flying at flying training school.
We missed this out, you see.
Yes.
Was it difficult to start then, looking back at that then? When you first start flying in formation, what's the knack of it? Is it
usually you first of all have your first trip or two with an instructor, and he says, "Now you've got to be careful on your throttle. Don't be vicious on your throttle. And if you see you're just dropping back, don't wham your throttle out and gradually ease the power forward so that you creep up. You've got to be very careful when you're so close."
And that was the key then, using the throttle.
Yes, not to be too vicious on the throttle.
Now, what about attack tactics, such as they were?
Yes, we used to do, we called them numbers one, numbers two, and number three attacks.
Now, what were they?
Gosh, now I'm trying to think. What were they? Number one. Attack. Actually, caught it, so you would have a chap who'd be flying straight and level, representing the target. And then you pull off out to one side and then come down and do... that's a number... I'm just trying to think what these numbers... Anyway, that would be a number one attack, I know.
So you curve in and then straighten up the last...
Yes, you come in and then gradually get behind and then pull away down. I can't remember what the number two attack was. Damn me. I think it was probably with two aircraft instead of one or something like that.
But that was a standard sort of thing.
Yes, yes.
Anything else you'd be practicing?
Oh, we did practice air firing. And
that's air firing at drogues and
no, into the sea.
At a target or just
no, because there were no targets there. So it was just a question of getting used to firing the guns. I mean, I'd done this at flying training school, but we only had one gun each side, and we had targets there. But with the Hurricane with the eight guns, it's just a question of getting used to firing the eight guns and getting the feel of them.
Now, were you carrying out any actual, well, reconnaissance or sort of defensive patrols?
No, none at all. No, because we were miles away from the German border.
You were just outside Le Havre.
Yeah. The Germans hadn't sent out over any attacks in our direction whatsoever. They hadn't, although we'd declared war on Germany, I think they sent one or two reconnaissance aircraft over this country, but they certainly didn't send them over where we were in France.
Now, in the book, and I think this may be a little, because I thought this was strange when I read it, that it talks about the whole squadron sitting by in cockpits, standing by for training patrols or former. I mean, would you actually do all that? Or, you know, it will.
Oh, yes, yes. If we were doing we might say we were going to do a squadron scramble. That's a practice scramble.
Tell me what a practice scramble. I mean, what was a scramble? How did you?
The scramble was to get off quickly, get the whole squadron off quickly. So we'd all be sitting in the cockpits, strapped in, and ready to go. And then we would get an instruction over the radio telephony, the RT, to start up. Or they might say, "Well, we're going to start up on the." Fire a Avery pistol with a coloured charge, and it might be that method of indicating pilots to start up. But and then we'd go and do a squadron formation. That was sort of thing. It was really to get together the whole squadron rather than flying just twos or three. We didn't fly in twos, but threes or sixes.
How quickly were you getting used to it? I mean, did you feel confident you'd had enough training at this stage before you went into action, or were you still conscious that you weren't very experienced?
Oh, I was still conscious that I recognised that I had quite a lot to learn.
So you weren't overconfident? Because that can be, towards the end of training, some people become overconfident.
Well, I wasn't like that. And I was trying to absorb everything and trying to learn everything. And because I knew I was comparatively inexperienced when it came to flying with a squadron, and I gradually sort of worked my way into the system and then became one of the chaps.
Now what about recreation? You weren't there long, were you, but any recreation while you were at Octobus?
Well, we used to go into Le Havre in the evenings, and we used to
what was that like?
It was quite good. We went to one or two lively places, including a brothel.
I'm not sure what you want to tell us about that sort of thing, but I mean...
No, better not put that in. And we used to go, then all the boys, see, after we'd had a few drinks, go to the bottom, all these women, there were about seven or eight of us there, and we had quite a lot of fun.
Were you drinking, was there much of a drinking culture there? Because you were sort of in between active service and not active service there.
Yes, yes.
Was there much drinking?
What we used to drink out there? Beer mainly, I think.
So you hadn't started on the wine and champagne then? That comes later.
No, that came later.
You also, there's quite a bit about swimming in the sea.
Oh, yes, because the weather was quite warm that year, in early September. And we used to, we were within walking distance of the sea where this airfield was. And used to go down and have a quick swim. I think we did it two or three times, not a lot, but it was quite nice.
Now, you then seem to move, still in September, to Noront, France.
Noront, Fonte. Yeah.
Fonte, yeah. That's near Saint-Omer.
No? Yes.
What was that airfield?
That was just a grass airfield, and when we were there, we were living in tents.
And what was that like? Tell us about the tents. Give us a description of them.
They were ridge tents where we slept, and two of us used to share one tent. And once again, I got some quite good photographs of all that. But and then our officers' mess tent was a large, marquee, not a huge marquee, but where we used to have our food.
Now, it says you were digging trenches there.
Yes.
You mean digging trenches for what? The defence of the airfield?
Yes. No, the defence of ourselves, because it was all round where our tents were, you see. So that if we were attacked from the air, we'd dart for the trench. And if you saw the photographs, you'd realise what they meant, what they were.
So how deep would they be? I mean, were they just what you call slit trenches, just for you and...
Oh, they weren't all that deep. About 4 or 5 feet.
How wide? Like a yard.
Yeah.
So, anything else you were doing there? We're still carrying on practice flights, I presume.
Oh, yes, we still did that. And then the weather turned a bit colder, and later, because we were there for about 2 weeks, I think. And then
so this is when early October you move, I think.
That's right. It got quite cold then, and then we were moved to a place called Rouvres, Rouvres, and that was south of Luxembourg, between Verdun and Metz. And we got down into this village called Rouvres, where I've been back to many times in the last few years.
Now, what was the airfield like there?
Just a grass airfield. Nothing more, nothing. You know, no runways or anything like that.
And what about your accommodation and the hangars?
No hangars.
So they just sat outside?
Oh, yeah.
Where were you accommodated?
The officers were accommodated in various houses throughout the village. And I was in a house with an old couple, and I had quite a comfortable bed, my own room, of course, but there's no hot water, no bathing facilities. And I had a batman, his name was Ashley.
I'll come back to him.
Yeah.
So what were these billets like? Were they comfortable? Or?
Yes. No hot water. I had a sort of washstand there, and on top of the washstand was a big bowl with a big jug in it, and this jug was full of cold water. And that was my washing water. So Ashley, my batman, used to come in every morning. He had access to the house. and used to bring me a cup of tea and some hot water for shaving. That was it. He used to come in.
And what was his role overall, Ashley, and how did you get on with him?
Oh, very well. He was a nice chap. He was batman to two or three of us, was it? I can't remember who the others were. Anyway, he used to come out to my house, because I was out a little way out of the centre of the village. And he used to drift out there in the mornings. About 7:30 or 8:30, something. Yeah, it's about 7:30. And bring me my tea and hot water. And I get up and...
Would he do your uniform, polish your boots, that sort of thing?
Oh, yes, yes, he used to polish my buttons and look after my uniform.
Would he tidy your room as well, or was that left to you?
No, he used to do that as well, yeah.
And how did you get on with that? I mean, were you friendly, or...?
Yes, oh yes, yeah. Yeah, he's, you know... We didn't call no Christian names or anything like that. He always called me Sir, and I called him Ashley. And it was quite good. It worked well.
Now, what were you doing? How did the routine start at Roof? Can you explain a bit about why you'd moved to Roof? Because you'd moved there for a purpose. I mean, you're now quite near the front line.
Yes.
Whatever you might call it.
Yes. Well, I'll tell you what happened. Number One Squadron were linked with us, and we went down to the southern half of France, or what we were classified as the southern half. It wasn't really in the south, but... And the other two Hurricane squadrons, 85 and 87, they stayed up north in the Lille area behind Belgium. And they formed the fighter element of an organisation known as the Air Component. We, numbers 1 and 73, we formed the Air Component of the Advanced Air Striking Force, the AASF as it was known. And our headquarters for the Advanced Air Striking Force was in Reims, or Reims, as some people call it. And that was about 90 to 100 miles west of where we were.
Now, what was your role then? You were just meant to patrol the frontier, or what?
We patrolled up and down the French-German border.
Right. I think we'll come back. Can I just ask, I should have asked earlier, about the mess, because I did the billets, and
forgot
the mess.
Yes.
Of course, you'd have an officer's mess.
Yes. We took over the local school as our officer's mess. It was in the centre of the village. Right next, or right adjacent to the local church, and still is. I've got. In fact, I've got a plate here, which shows you.
And what was the atmosphere like in the mess?
Oh, it was good. We set up a bar and had a well stocked bar, some of the French liqueurs and some of the unusual drinks which we hadn't been getting in England, and had plenty of French beer, which was quite good. And we had one or two, we managed to find a couple of easy chairs. So anyway, we were reasonably comfortable. We had the bar in the corner, and we used to eat in the same room.
What was the food like?
Pretty basic, but quite good. Yeah.
Did you pay extra to get a bit extra than your rations, or, you know, did it operate from your rations?
I can't remember what we did in France. Certainly in officers' messes in the UK, yes, we did pay a bit of extra, but I couldn't, bless you, if I can remember what system we used in France.
Now, tell me about we'll look at sort of more about going out into, you know, drinking it in the local village, town city. But what about the actual operations as such? You were patrolling. That was your role, patrolling the border.
Yes, we used to patrol in threes for an hour on the patrol line. So we were, our airborne time was about an hour and a half, hour and three quarters, because you had to get up there. And we used to patrol at about 25,000 feet in those hurricane ones.
Now, you just went along the border. You didn't go over into Germany then?
No. No, we went up and down, sort of just within, on the French side. And sometimes we would patrol in the northern sector from about, Metz, and then down to
Verdun.
No, no, Verdun was further back.
The other way, sorry, yes.
Yeah. Can't remember the names of quite large towns. Anyway, we used to patrol up and down between, and then after an hour on patrol, we would be relieved, and another three would come up, and we would go back.
Now, did anything ever happen on them?
Yes.
At that stage?
Not immediately, no, it didn't. But after we'd been going for two or three weeks, a couple of weeks or so, yes, sometimes 109s used to come up from Germany to have a look at us, see what we were doing. And occasionally a little bit of combat ensued, and I know Copper Cane got a 109, and on the 6th of November 1939.
Hang on, I think we'll hold off that. That's your one of your first contacts.
Yeah,
I remember that. Now, can we talk about a bit about the system then as well? So how was it all set up operationally? Did you have an operations room?
Yes, we did. I was over in a dugout by our airfield. Airmen with radios, but they hadn't got a great deal of range. And when we were way over on patrol, really, we lost touch with the ground control. But they were, when we got nearer the airfield, we could contact them.
And were there any system for early warning, any early warning system at all from either radar? Well, I don't think they have radar out there, but I mean anything at all to let you know that.
Yes, our early warning system was something incredible. Down one side of the airfield, the French army had dug, a small unit of the French army had dug a big pit. And they'd settled themselves in there, and they had a powerful pair of binoculars. And they were looking towards the east, and if they saw an aircraft coming over, which they identified as German, then they would let us know, or if they couldn't identify it, they would still let us know. And the method of letting us know, the early warning system, was they used to wave a red flag. And our chaps, we had ridge tents as our flight officers at the airfield, and I was doing a job one day, and they said, "Oh, the red flag's waving." So if you knew that they'd seen something, where or what, we didn't know. But I can give you an instance when I could tell you a bit more about that.
We'll come to that. So that was it. There was no wireless warning from anywhere further forward?
None whatsoever.
That doesn't sound much use.
No, it wasn't.